This tape is a production of All Roads Ministry. Your speaker is Vin Lewis, president and founder of All Roads Ministry. This tape is entitled No Salvation. This tape is designed to deal with and give some background, some justification, and some explanation, at least from my own personal point of view, on the doctrine of no salvation outside the church. It is an unfortunate sign of our times that this doctrine appears to be one which raises controversy among Catholics who seem to be, at least on the surface, functioning in good faith, yet they disagree. The problem is, how can one understand that one must be a Catholic in order to be saved, which means become properly submissive to the will of God and function in accord with his plan for salvation? How can one reconcile this requirement for membership with the apparent fact that some people live and die without being offered the opportunity to become members of the Roman Catholic Church? This leads to a dilemma. On one hand, if we insist that truth is important, adherence to truth is important, knowledge of truth is important, and affirmation of truth is important, and by important in this case I mean essential, then it would follow, as the Athanasian Creed says, one of the foundational creeds of the Roman Catholic Church, that in order to be saved, you must hold, adhere, defend, and acknowledge those truths contained in the Roman Catholic Church. On the other hand, is it not apparent that people live and die without ever being invited into the Catholic Church, without ever being taught the truth of the doctrine of the Assumption, or the Real Presence, or the Immaculate Conception, or any of the other doctrines of the faith which are necessary for salvation? The compromise position, which many people seem to offer, is one which makes things worse. Namely, it says that there are two paths to salvation. The Roman Catholic, because he has been given the greater grace and the greater benefits, is somehow required to believe things that the infidel or the pagan or the heretic or the Protestant or the Jew are not required to believe. This position, although on first glance or first inspection seems to be satisfying, is in fact blasphemous. The problem with it is that it now requires an extra standard for Catholics, and second, two paths for salvation. Allow me to elaborate on it slightly. If a Roman Catholic is required to believe in the truth of the Immaculate Conception, while a Protestant, a Jew, a Muslim, etc., these people are not required to do so, and by required here I mean as a necessary condition prior to entering heaven, then what we have is the situation where, should the Catholic live a good life but deny the Immaculate Conception on his deathbed, he goes to hell for all eternity. If, however, the Protestant, or the Jew, or the Muslim, denies the Immaculate Conception, in fact, preaches against the Immaculate Conception for his entire life, he goes to heaven, because he is not responsible for this truth. In other words, the logical consequence of this is that it is much better to be a non-Catholic, as it is much easier for a non-Catholic to get to heaven. And if it is easier for a non-Catholic to get to heaven than it is for a Catholic to get to heaven, then what God has done is put not a gift upon us, but a curse upon us by calling us to believe his truth. And also by the same token, it follows inescapably and irrefutably that those who are called to the fullness of faith are called to, rather than an easier chance of salvation, a higher probability of damnation. It's sort of like marking on the curve. In other words, there are no absolute standards by which the teacher grades, but he only grades in comparison to other people, and even takes into account the concept of the abilities of the person involved. This conflicts with any true sense of justice, but it also conflicts with any true sense of truth and the value of truth. If there is more than one way to be saved, then Jesus established a church simply for purposes of social reasons. It is a place for people to come together, to enjoy each other's company, to participate in things they like to do, to have psychological improvements and emotional uplifting and affirmation in the true social sense. In other words, Jesus established the Catholic Church in exactly the same reason and in exactly the same way that Protestant churches were founded, that is, as social clubs where people with like inclinations, like desires, and like whims could come together to pat each other on the back and to see what the women are wearing, and so that the men would not have to do physical labor and can come inside when the weather is inclement. If we hold this, we cannot be Christians in any definition of the word, and certainly we cannot be Catholics. The teachings of the Church are clear on this. From the very beginning, the Church Fathers, the Church Doctors have taught that one must be a member of the Roman Catholic Church in order to be saved. The Council documents are clear, and I have quoted them in other tapes, and they are readily available, so I will not quote them now. What I am going to attempt to do in this tape, and again, it is my own attempt, and I point out that to my best of my knowledge, although none of what I shall say is in conflict with church teaching, I present it as my own opinion, my own speculative theological approach to this doctrine, or I should say, not to the doctrine itself, but to the supporting arguments and explanation of the doctrine. I shall frequently use analogies because I believe the analogies will make it clearer why people who apparently have never been offered the opportunity to enter the church may be justly sent to hell. Now, I say apparently many times here that this person apparently is not offered, this person apparently is not offered the opportunity, and that person is not offered the opportunity in the sense that nobody preaches to him, that there is no close by Catholic Church, etc. This is the ignorant native argument. Unless I specify otherwise, we shall assume that this does happen in reality. The reason we must assume this is because to say that it is absolutely guaranteed that no one anywhere has the opportunity, allow me to rephrase that, that anyone anywhere is denied the opportunity to come into the church because of the human accidents of geography or chronology. In other words, no Catholic missionary or no Catholic person comes into this ignorant person's life. The so-called person in the middle of the Gobi Desert, the Bushman in the Kalahari. If we are to hold that no human being does that, we cannot, therefore, presume that God cannot work a miracle. But right now, we're leaving the miraculous out, and we're working on the assumption, I repeat again, an assumption that the ignorant native who lives in the Kalahari or lives in that small village in the middle of China does not have access, does not learn, does not discover the truths of Roman Catholicism. And again, let us examine this situation and see if this is any problem with the doctrine of no salvation outside the church, the concept of salvation being offered to all men, and with the concept of there being only one path of salvation through the cross and through the acceptance of truth taught by the institution established by Jesus Christ for all times as the sole means of salvation for man. I would like to start the examination or the explanation proper with a quote, or at least a paraphrase, from William Shakespeare in Macbeth. There is a rather famous quote which many people are familiar with, in which Macbeth, feeling some of the qualms of conscience of having killed his own king, says, "All the world is a stage." And then he goes on to say that in essence, each man is given a part, and that he comes on briefly, says his lines, and then goes off. And then, in despair engendered by his horrible crime, he says that life is a play written by an idiot, full of sound and fury, but signifying nothing. The key concept here is let us attempt to think of a play. Let us attempt to think of what lines are. A play may very well, I believe, especially for an illustration like this, be compared to life. A person outside of the play, a playwright, a producer, a director, etc., plan a procedure, a sequence of events according to a set plan. They assign certain people roles in the play. They are given jobs to do, movements to accomplish, lines to say, emotions and activities to convey to the audience who watches. And if they do this correctly, they will be hired, they will be paid, they will be rewarded, both literally with a salary and with good reviews from critics, which possibly will allow them to continue their career or improve their career, getting other assignments, other acting jobs. The way an actor is hired is that he responds to the notice of an audition. In an audition, he comes, and what he does is he reads for the part. Then the director, the playwright, the producer, whoever else is in charge, listens and makes a decision. Now, the way a person gets the role, outside of the possibility of a little bit of luck, and we'll discount that to make the analogy more simple, is that he, number one, expresses the intention for the desire of the role by appearing, and number two, by the skills or the natural abilities which he has developed by practice, he presents himself in such a fashion as being capable of portraying the role. So again, let us examine the situation of Macbeth. The notice goes out in the newspapers that there is open auditions. People show up saying, I wish to play the role of Macbeth. They plan, they read, they act a little bit, and the people in charge make the decisions. Those that they say to, well, listen, thank you very much, don't call us, we'll call you, are rejected and go away. Or perhaps they're offered a secondary role. Those who are accepted ultimately become Macbeth or Macbeth's understudy, or perhaps Macbeth in the second part of the run of the play when the first cast leaves. But in order to become part of this play, in order to literally learn the entire part of Macbeth and say it on the stage and be part of the play, you must first show up and second, prove yourself worthy. In other words, you must first believe that the play exists, believe that these people are putting it on, believe that there is a role for you, and believe that you can do it. There's an interesting line in the Epistle of Hebrews that says, you must first believe that God exists and that he rewards those who seek him. In the same sense, you cannot get into the play, you cannot become the actor, unless you first believe it exists, find its location, and then read for it. It would be the epitome of idiocy, the absolute apex of lunacy, for a person to complain that he has not been picked to portray Macbeth in a play when he never showed up for the auditions. It would be absolute arrogance to say, I'm sitting here alone, they don't know about me, but they should come out, knock at my door, and offer me the role. We would think that this is rather silly. We would say, if we wish to, looking at the whole thing, that this person is not going to get the role. In a very certain sense, he has predestined himself never to play in a play, because he will never take the first step to pursue it. And for him to claim that somehow he has been treated unjustly because he has not received the rewards of the play, the salary, the critical acclaim, the fame, etc., is by no means an injustice. He simply did not do what he was supposed to do. Let us bring this now into, if we can, somewhat of an analogy of entering the church. In order to enter the church, you must first come to the conclusion that it exists. This does not mean to say that one believes that it is the Roman Catholic Church. But if we hold, and we must, that there is a law written on everyone's heart, as St. Paul writes in the Epistle to Romans, in other words, natural law, and if we believe, as we should, as St. Augustine says, that our hearts are made for God and will be restless until the time we rest in the hands, in the palms of God, then we must understand that each man, and by this I mean, of course, women, seek their life's meaning in their daily life. In other words, the normal concepts of suffering and the normal concepts of injustice make our hearts cry out for something else which will give meaning to the suffering and the injustice of life. When we see the newborn suffer, our own children, when we suffer our own, what we consider, undeserved disasters in life, inside of us, our senses, our deepest part of our humanity, cries out and says, there must be something else beyond me, beyond humankind, beyond this life, which makes everything right, which metes out justice, which shows some significance for the suffering that I'm going through now. Now, this something else, therefore, compels a person to seek an answer. If he seeks an answer in any other system other than Catholicism, what he will find is that the answer is unsatisfactory, the pain continues, the dis-ease continues, the uneasiness continues, and in many ways possibly even gets worse. What he does at this point is either continues to seek that something else, and we'll deal with that in a moment, or he despairs. And by despairing, he commits a form of suicide. It may actually be a physical suicide. It may actually be that he ends his own life thinking that life is insignificant, life is full of sound and fury, written by an idiot, signifying nothing, as Shakespeare put it so well. If he believes that, then like Macbeth, he sleepwalks through his life in a slow and muffled march to the grave, dreading death and yet seeking it. Or as the line goes in the old song, Old Man River, afraid of living but scared of dying. Now, or tired of living and scared of dying. If that type of suicide occurs, whether it be the physical type or the spiritual type in which the person attempts to kill his conscience, kill his soul, kill his sense of right and wrong in him by some form of drowning in pleasure. Now, the drowning in pleasure may take the place of drugs, sexual activity, it may take the place of alcohol, food, or any one of the other vices, including masochism, which sometimes appears as a misplaced form of asceticism. So sometimes when we see the Hindu holy man lying on the bed of nails, or going through the yoga contortions, which seem to bring great pain, we say this man is a great ascetic. No, this man is a hedonist. He is trying to kill, as the Buddhist will say, or as the Hindu will say, the desire in him so that he may literally get off the wheel of karma and, by destroying his karma, ultimately go to nirvana, which is extinction. In other words, the entire effort is geared towards a suicide, a concept of the extinction of the human life, a denial of the human condition, a denial that there is fulfillment. If this occurs, what we have is a situation where a person is killing himself, killing his human nature, and he is, in the truest sense of the word, rejecting God, the Creator. Let us now think of a situation at a judgment of the soul. The person is standing in front of Jesus, and Jesus says, "You are going to hell." And the person says, "Why?" And Jesus says, "Because you don't believe in the Immaculate Conception." And the man says, "I didn't know anything about it. You never sent anybody to me to tell me about it. After all, how could you hold me responsible for something I was never taught?" And Jesus points out that on October 3rd, he sent a missionary to the man's house. But the man objects and says, "But Lord, on October 2nd, I killed myself with an overdose of sleeping pills." And Jesus says, "Yes, and suicide is a mortal sin, and you are condemned to hell for a mortal sin. You never got to the point of learning the Immaculate Conception. Yes, you were ignorant, but your suicide makes you culpably ignorant. That is to say, you are worthy of blame and conviction for your ignorance." What you did was refuse to learn by turning yourself away and not being receptive. It is somewhat analogous to turning off the radio and then complaining that you didn't hear your favorite song. The radio must be on, and you must be listening in order to hear the music or the news that you desire to hear. Let us again deal with this basic concept. In order to get into the play of life, one must believe that the play has a meaning. And of course, this comes from the basic law written in our heart, our basic desire for the something else. One must begin to study for the role, develop certain skills, learn the acting profession. And how does one do this? By following the natural virtues which are in us. Every political system which has ever expressed this law advocates certain basic principles. Parents should take care of their children. Marriages should last forever. Mercy should be preferred over justice. Stealing is wrong. Lying is wrong. These basic concepts go through all of political systems, with very few perverted exceptions, which didn't last long. What this is reflecting is the basic human nature of man, which again accepts and seeks affirmation by a moral system outside of man. This is natural law. These are natural virtues. And as the old expression goes, grace builds upon nature. He who sees this, and by study, I don't necessarily mean someone stays into a library and reads a bunch of dusty books. No, the study which takes place in human life, the very activity of living, proves to us certain things. And again, creates an uneasiness in us which can only be satisfied in God. This something else factor is in every human being. What is there beyond me which will give me satisfaction? Why is it that I continually seek happiness and never get it completely fulfilled? Why is it that even when my most specific desires for happiness are specifically and completely fulfilled, there's always something missing? Well, that's because of the natural law on our hearts written by God, which says, "Seek me." This is the preparation for the audition. Now, if we go on for the audition, if we go on for that concept, if we go on for seeking that goal, what we are doing is developing our skills. Now, if we wish to be an actor, where do we go? We go to the place where plays are being produced. We read the trade papers to look for open auditions. And then, perhaps, we get books out of libraries where we begin to start to read the famous plays or techniques on acting. And if we can, we go to an actor's school. We also attend as much theater as we can. And ultimately, we'll find a niche. We would like to be a Shakespearean actor, a comic actor, a musical actor, an opera singer, etc. We will find that niche. Then, our degree of reward depends on our innate skills, how well we develop them, and our perseverance. In the same sense, let us look at life. The concept of God is that God creates each one of us as a specific act of creation at our moment of conception. At our moment of conception is fixed our gender, our ultimate height, our, quote, natural weight, our hair color, and our tendency to lose our hair later in life, our eye color, genetic tendencies towards certain diseases, such things as whether our eyes will be good most of our lives or whether we will have blindness, our tendency towards deafness or our tendency towards acute hearing. Also, what is fixed at that moment is our parents, our brothers and sisters, our family context, our place in history. We're born in the 20th century or the 19th century or the 2nd century, not by accident, but because this vast play of life, this vast plan by which God ultimately will reconcile the world to himself by the death of his son, has a specific place for us. Our moment of death is fixed, written in a book, predestined by God. And we may violate this rule, of course, by suicide. But otherwise, as the Bible says, you will not die, even though men fall to your right and men fall to your left in battle, because you are in the palm of God's hands. Kill yourself, yes, but otherwise, He has a plan for you. You are predestined to fulfill a plan in accord with God's script of the play of history, of salvation history, of church history, and of world history. No one can be born at the wrong time. No one can be born at the wrong place. No one can be conceived as the wrong gender or the wrong race or with the wrong genetic tendencies. There are no mistakes in God's plan. Now, it is our obligation, our goal, our situation where we must therefore determine by study, by examination, by introspection, what that plan is that God has for each of us. And it is our job to find that place, learn our lines, study them. And if we die in the second act, or die in the third, or live happily ever after in the fifth, that is because of the playwright. But we can do the job well, or do the job badly, and therefore receive a reward. In that same sense, God has written the play. He is the producer. He is the playwright. He is the director. Our job is to fulfill His goals. And again, we must show up for rehearsals. We must be faithful to the lines as written. Otherwise, we not only destroy our own career, we foul up the play. And it may require rewrites by the director and the playwright before it opens on Broadway. I wish at this point to emphasize it again, because on the second part of the tape, I will work on the foundation which I have established. I am using the analogy that God knows what He's doing in the same sense that the playwright and director know what they're doing. There is an end result which must be achieved. And if we start to use again, to follow the analogy, if for some reason you had only a small part in the play, and for some reason were not interested in how the play began or end, or what the entire consequences of it were, you might very well show up 5 minutes before you go on, say your five or six lines, walk off, and go home, and never see the beginning or end of the play. You would still be fulfilling your function, but you would be functioning in the true sense of blind faith of the playwright, of the critics, of the audience, and everyone else, in saying, well, I guess this thing does work out well. That is a legitimate way to do it, although it is not the most fulfilling way to do it. If you wish to see only your part, then you must function in blind faith. If you wish to expand it and stand in the wings or sit in the audience and watch the rest of the play so that you see the entire program, then perhaps your motivation might be a little stronger. And also, if another actor should falter and forget a line, you may be able to ad-lib and replace the line and keep the sequence and the theme of the play alive, even though someone else falters. Again, I know I'm using an analogy, and in all cases, analogies fail at a certain point, but let me again use one other quick one. If you're not graduated from grammar school, and then don't go on to high school, or if you go on to high school and are not graduated from there, or if you go on to college and are not graduated from there, you have no complaint that you have not, no justifiable complaint that you have not been admitted to graduate school, because all of the other conditions were necessary for graduate school. You will never get the master's degree unless you get the other things first. And therefore, when someone hire someone for a job and a requirement is the master's degree, you have no give a foundational statement to the rest of the examination. I would also expect that if you do not accept the analogy, that you go through and listen through it again. Now, let us return to the basic issue here. What we are dealing with is the basic issue of salvation and damnation. I tried to, in the last part, in the last analogy I used, the concept of getting from one school to another, being graduated from each school before you can go on to the next, to deal with the concept of a selection process. If you qualify for stage A, you go to stage B. If you qualify for stage B, you go to stage C. If you qualify for stage D, you go to stage E, and then F, and then G, etc. Let us understand that in order to be saved, that is, ultimately, in order to enter heaven, one must be perfect. Jesus makes this extremely clear. I refer you to Matthew chapter 5, verse 48. Now, in order to be made perfect, imperfections must be removed, and, as nothing defiled can enter heaven, as the book of Revelation teaches, then if you are defiled in any way, you cannot enter heaven. Catholic theology, and of course the whole concept of a mortal sin, a sin leading unto death, as pointed out in the first letter of St. John, means that one sin leading unto death will condemn a person. To use another analogy, if one is talking about killing someone, one may cut his head off, stab him in the heart, give him poison, or strangle him, preventing air from reaching his brain or his lungs. Any one of these alone will cause the death of a person. Any mortal sin alone will cause the death of the soul. Any mortal sin alone will put a person in hell. Therefore, if a person is condemned to hell because of an act of suicide, in other words, a situation where, as I explained before, either a slow, gradual spiritual suicide or the actual physical extinction of one's life by one's own hands, then one justifiably goes to hell. This is clear, this is understandable, and there are no problems. He does not even get to the stage where he is asked whether he believes in the Assumption or affirms the doctrines of the Immaculate Conception. In a very real sense of the word, he is absolutely invincibly ignorant. Through, quote, no fault of his own, unquote, he was not explained these doctrines. He was not given the opportunity to believe. And the reason he was not given the opportunity to believe is because he killed himself, either spiritually and hardened his heart and plugged his ears and put the scales over his own eyes so that no one could lead him to this, nor could he lead himself, or he killed himself so that no one could speak to him. Yes, these people are invincibly ignorant. Yes, they go to hell as invincibly ignorant, but not because they are invincibly ignorant, but because they fail to respond to the law written in their heart, which says there is something else that they must seek, something else they must do, something else they must learn, something else they must adhere to. St. Paul, in his letter to the Romans, chapter 2, says that those who in essence, have not had the gospel preached to them, will be judged by the law written on their hearts. Of course, this is exactly what I'm saying. The law written on their hearts says there is a gospel somewhere that you need to learn. If you do not seek that gospel, then the law in your heart is violated, and that alone will condemn a man at Judgment Day. If, however, the law in his heart says seek something, what does Jesus tell us repeatedly? Seek and you shall find. And that is a principle which we must accept. He who seeks God will find him. There is another specific passage that deals with this. This passage is in the Epistle to Hebrews, chapter 11, verse 6. But without faith, it is impossible to please him, referring to God. Anyone who comes to God must first believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. In other words, if you do not believe God exists, you cannot come to him. And he rewards those who seek him. How does he reward them? He rewards them by faith, by grace, ultimately by the opportunities to salvation. In Matthew chapter 13, we have Jesus telling us that he who has little will lose what he has, while he who has much will be given more. In other words, as I see it, this is a progressive concept. We are in a play. It is not static. The play progresses. The plot proceeds. Our part in it is to continue to grow in faith, to continue to seek God. If a man does not do so, he is rejecting the nature of God, the nature of man. He condemns himself by this mortal sin. And he does not, absolutely, does not enter the formal membership of the Roman Catholic Church. If, however, he does seek those things, then what we are to believe is that in seeking God, he will get the reward. Now, one of the objections would be here, and it is frequently raised, what about the person who comes to the acknowledgement that God exists, starts to seek him, and dies before he gets the full knowledge? Well, two things. One is, one can die either by suicide or by some other activity. We have already pointed out that suicide, the ultimate act of defiance of God, the ultimate rejection of life, of the gift of life, deserves eternal damnation and therefore will lead to a mortal sin. However, in no other way can a man die other than suicide without God giving permission. In other words, there are no freak accidents and there are no murders which occur without God giving permission. To give a very simple example of this from the New Testament, in the Gospel of St. Mark, chapter 4, we have the famous story of the storm on the lake. Jesus is sleeping soundly, and the apostles wake him up, essentially saying, "Don't you care that we die?" And he rebukes them and then rebukes the seas and says, "Don't you have any faith?" The point is, I believe, what he was trying to say to them, and of course to us, and why it was recorded is, no matter how bad the storm looks, you cannot yet die until God allows you to die. Our lives are predetermined. We may short-circuit them through our free will. Our salvation is predetermined. We may, again, reject it if we choose to do so. But these people, these apostles, had a role in life. They were to be the first bishops of the church. They were to spread the word throughout the world. They were to start the apostolic succession. They could not die until the Feast of Pentecost. They could not die until they became bishops. And no matter how bad the situation looked, they couldn't end their life until their goals were fulfilled, except like Judas, by taking their own lives. Interesting point why Judas dies of suicide. I believe that is why Jesus rebukes them and points out about how little faith they have. Now, what we also have, I believe, as an objection here is when people say, yes, but what about the guy in the village who lives a good life, etc., 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 and never gets anybody to speak to him. Well, there's an interesting passage in the Epistle of Romans, starting at chapter 8, verse 29, which seems to talk about predestination. And what it does is it goes something like this. We know that God makes all things work together for the good of those who have been called according to his decree. Those whom he foreknew, he predestined to share in the image of his Son, and that the Son might be the firstborn of many brothers. Those he predestined, he likewise called. Those he called, he also justified. And those he justified, he in turn glorified. What shall we say after that? If God is for us, who can be against us? Now, notice the key word here, foreknew. If you know in advance that someone is going to reject a message, or if you know in advance that a message you're going to give is inappropriate or inapplicable, you are quite literally wasting your time in giving the message. Now, as an example, if one thought that natural family planning were a good thing to teach, you would not have only senior citizens in your class. You certainly wouldn't give the information to 70-year-old single women. Not because the information is incorrect, it's simply inapplicable. By the same token, there are times when one knows that certain messages are not going to get across. To put it on a purely secular matter, the true sports fanatic will not believe that his team can lose the key game. And talking to him might be an interesting conversation, but you're not going to change his mind. It's very difficult to talk to the mother and somehow explain that her child really isn't as attractive, as intelligent, and as exceptional as she thinks her child is. One understands that one is wasting one's time trying to explain such a situation. Now, some people, because of the hardness of their hearts, because of their total commitment towards evil, because of their total advocacy of the rejection of God, are not going to listen to the message of God. They are going to reject it. I am not saying that we can always judge who these people are, but I certainly am saying that God can always judge who these people are because he foreknows them in advance. And therefore, it is an argument, it is certainly an explanation, that these people are rejected because they reject. Again, one goes to hell because one ultimately rejects the grace that God gives one. If God can tell in advance that this will happen, then therefore, perhaps this is an explanation not only of that passage which many Protestants will use for predestination, but to explain why many so-called ignorant natives seem to go through their entire lives without getting the message of Jesus presented to them. Again, one would say, why are we giving messages to people when they would reject it? But an objection might be raised. Are we not commanded by Jesus to spread the gospel through the whole world and to preach to every living creature? Yes, but Jesus also tells us to not cast our pearls before swine. This famous passage takes place at the beginning of St. Matthew's, in chapter 7 of St. Matthew's Gospel. And it starts at verse 1. It says, if you want to avoid judgment, stop passing judgment. Your verdict on others will be the verdict passed on you. The message with which you measure will be used to measure you. Why look at the speck in your brother's eye when you miss the plank in your own? How can you say to your brother, let me take that speck out of your eye, when all the time the plank remains in your own? You hypocrite. Remove the plank from your own eye first, then you will see clearly to take the speck from your brother's eyes. Do not give what is holy to dogs, or toss your pearls before swine. They will trample them underfoot at best, and perhaps even tear them to shreds. Interesting. Now, of course, the next line says, ask and you shall receive, seek and you will find, knock and it will be open to you. The one who asks receives, the one who seeks finds, the one who knocks enters. I'll continue. Would one of you hand his son a stone when he asks for a loaf, or a poisonous snake when he asks for a fish? If you, with all your sins, know how to give your children what is good, how much more will your heavenly Father give good things to anyone who asks him? Now, a couple of points here. One of the major problems that we have with this no salvation outside the church concept is that people are Catholics arguing, presenting, how about the non-Catholics? Instead of focusing on their own defects, instead of focusing on their own confessional state and how good they're making confessions, how well they're attending Mass, how well they're evangelizing, instead what they are is trying to notice the defects in other people's salvations. Interesting point. Instead of removing their own defects, they concentrate on the imagined defects of others. Number two, Jesus says, God will give to anyone who asks. We are all created. Do these people ask? No. So therefore, as God foreknows that they will not ask, he does not give. Of course, if they were, quote, to change their mind, he would give. Jesus' words will endure forever and certainly speak truth. But notice the other commandment given to us. Do not give what is holy to dogs or cast your pearls before swine. Again, not understanding fully the Semitic concept, both dogs and pigs, swine, were considered extremely degrading animals in those times. What Jesus here is saying is, quite literally, don't waste your time on those who won't listen. How are we to determine that? Well, there are ways to determine swine and there are ways to determine pigs. And again, if we use the judgment correctly, mainly I would think by listening to the words of the people we deal with and noticing that they use the same words we do when we try to avoid our sinful nature, when we fall into the sins of infidelity, of which ultimately every sin is. Again, notice what Jesus tells his followers in Luke chapter 10. He tells them, when you go into a village and they will not welcome you, shake the dust of your feet off of the sandals, and then this will act as testimony against them in judgment day. He doesn't say stay there and persevere endlessly. No. Interestingly enough, there are other passages which deal with this. St. Paul advises that we deal with a heretic once, maybe twice, then leave him alone. Jesus tells us in Matthew 18 that if a person will not listen to the church, exclude him from the church and treat him as you would a tax collector or an infidel, a non-believer. In other words, there is a definite concept here of that those who refuse to believe are not to be allowed into the mysteries, not given what is holy. Again, if one reads the Synoptic Gospels, one finds frequent references to the fact that Jesus spoke parables to the common people so that they would not understand, but gave the interior mysteries, the true faith, the secrets, if one wishes to say that, to the apostles. And the apostles were later to make the secrets public. It was through them that the public revelation took place. And it was through them that the teachings were to be made known to everyone. Now, interestingly enough, so it seems to me, all of this seems to tie into the concept that a man makes a choice through his personality, through the development of his personality, through dealing with the natural law on his heart, of accepting the invitation that God gives to everyone. Now, let's again deal with the concept of invitation here in the sense of a form of an analogy. If you are invited to a party and you choose not to go, you will not know what occurs in the party. You will miss a good time or perhaps a bad time. You will miss the friendship and the companionship of the people at the party. It would be absurd later for someone to feel as if they missed something unjustly because they rejected going. Again, those of us who choose not to become medical doctors cannot complain when we are ignorant of medical conditions. Those of us who choose not to become carpenters cannot complain, justly that is, when we are incapable of building a cabinet or building a stairway out of wood. Because we did not seek the training, we did not seek the knowledge, we did not learn how to do these things, therefore we are, quote, condemned to ignorance of that field. And if that field becomes important to us, if we have a certain uneasiness because we do not have a stairway or do not have a cabinet or do not know about the diseases which rack our body, then we have one of two things. We may seek out the knowledge either through some formal training or our own individual research, or we may rely on others on the assumption that there are people who can build such stairways, then we hire a carpenter, listen to his expertise, or we go to a doctor and submit ourselves to his treatment. If we do not do this, what we are rejecting is the concept of repair of either the stairway or the illness. We are saying that the normal state of man is to have places in which he cannot walk because the stairs have fallen down, or diseases which he cannot heal, because it is natural for him to be in pain and unhealthy. And if you accept this, what you are rejecting is one of the basic truths of human behavior, which the whole world gives evidence to in opposition. By the same token, every single one of us, again, is written with that natural law in our heart, which says there's something else. Something else being God, which we must seek, and God will reward. But he knows in advance, in so much as we can use that term with God, those who will seek him and those who will not. And so therefore, he does not waste his time, so to speak, nor does he require you to waste your time on those who will not accept the teachings of the church. There is an interesting passage here which I believe is appropriate. It appears in the Gospel of St. Luke, chapter 12. Jesus is talking about how the lilies of the field are, and I'll start with verse 27. Or take the lilies, they do not spin, they do not weave, but I tell you, Solomon, in all of his splendor, was not arrayed like any of them. If God clothes in such splendor the grass of the field, which grows today and is thrown on the fire tomorrow, how much more will he provide for you? O weak in faith, is it not for you to be in search of what you are to eat or drink? Stop worrying. The unbelievers of this world are always running after such things. Your Father knows that you need such things. Seek out instead his kingship over you, and the rest will follow. Now, I believe the primary literal meaning of this is to talk about those physical things we need. But if Jesus promises us that God will provide for us our physical needs if we seek out instead his kingship over us, Are we to believe that God would keep us alive by physical means alone, which he will provide for us, only to make sure that we have no opportunity to enter the church or go to hell, or contradict every other thing as far as the value of truth and allow those in who do not accept the truth of the Catholic faith? In other words, if God provides us what is necessary to keep our physical life alive, will he not also provide us what is necessary for us to enter into the spiritual life? Yes, he will, if, and it's the big if, as Jesus points out here, if we first seek his kingship over us. And again, is that not written in our heart? Yes, of course it is. Therefore, if we posit or accept the existence of God and seek him out, if we seek out his kingship, if we make ourselves submissive, he will provide the means and the opportunity for not only for us to stay physically alive, but for us to spiritually grow, so that, unlike the person who has little that will be taken away, the rest of us will be given much. All right, now, what about the arguments that people can use, again, that somehow in seeking faith one will die? Well, in essence, I've tried to deal with this before. You cannot die except God sees that it is coming and allows it to occur. There are no freak accidents. You cannot die in the plane crash while you are flying to Rome to be baptized by the Pope. This cannot happen. If you believe it can happen, then you believe that God does not have control over such physical things. All of us, if we look through our lives, can probably figure many times when we could very well have died. But we did not, because God kept us alive because our part in the play of life had not yet been fulfilled. We had not yet set all of our lines. Again, the only alternative is the rejection of him, which is a form of spiritual suicide or physical suicide. Let me try again, if I have not made it clear, to deal with the concept of damnation. Now, again, what we are arguing is that he who does not enter the Catholic Church is damned. All right. We are not saying that he who does enter the Catholic Church is saved. We are simply saying he who does not is damned. Let us again use an analogy. If the Church is necessary for salvation, then if you do not have it, you are damned. If, as an example, the belief in the Immaculate Conception is necessary for salvation, you are damned. Let us again use an analogy of life, and Jesus certainly uses this in the concept of eternal life. Let us use salvation as life, let us use damnation as death. And let me see if I can try to make this situation a little clearer. In order to live, in order to sustain your life, you need a number of necessary elements present. Air, water, sufficient amount of heat and shelter, food, and freedom from literally fatal diseases. In other words, your body must be functioning in a certain fashion, your kidneys must be working correctly, your liver, etc. So what we have is basic health, air, food, water, shelter. Of course, also things like sleep. Now, let us imagine a hospital in which a man is seriously ill, and in which, of course, because he is in the hospital, he is guaranteed a proper medical care for medicine, food, oxygen, water. Let us say that the nurse comes upon him and finds that the man has died. Instead of serving the meal, she takes it away. She removes the water, she turns off the oxygen. The family members come in and say, "But wait a minute, did we not contract for oxygen, for food, for water?" And they would say, "Well, yes, but he's dead, he cannot use it." And if one were to focus not on the food, the water, and everything else, but one were to focus just on the concept that the water was taken away, one would be considered incredibly silly. A dead man cannot drink. The water is quite literally going to waste. Let us use a similar analogy. If the soul is dead, if the man, in his development of his personality, rejects God, if he spends his entire life doing this, the knowledge of the Immaculate Conception is totally useless. Yes, knowledge of the Immaculate Conception is necessary for salvation, but if you kill yourself spiritually or physically before you come to this knowledge, then it is a waste of time and rather silly to complain that one is being sent to hell because one did not accept it. It is one's own fault that one did not discover and learn the truth. Again, I point out that if we do believe in God, if we do believe that He created all of us by specific actions, if we do believe that He does have a plan for all of us, if we do believe that He knew us in our mother's wombs, if we do believe that it was only the infusion of the soul at the moment of conception by which we came about, if we believe all of these things, then we must believe that He has a plan for each of us by which, as St. Paul says, by which all men of us may come to know the truth and be saved. And again, I would like at this point to introduce the concept of the miraculous. Let us note in the Acts of the Apostles the actions of St. Philip. In chapter 8, we have the situation where an Ethiopian is returning to Ethiopia, having come to the temple to worship, and quite literally, through a miraculous intervention, St. Philip is brought to him, preaches the gospel to him, baptizes him, and then goes back to the bosom of the church, so to speak, while the Ethiopian continues on his way. In other words, what we have is a specific situation of the intervention of God using human intermediaries in the affairs of man so that a man will have the opportunity of salvation. If this story is to be believed, and it must be believed, then we must understand that the Ethiopian, and the reason this activity took place for the Ethiopian, is an expression of God's love for man, that no man may go to hell except by a conscious rejecting of God. And that if man, such as this Ethiopian, seeks God, seeks knowledge — the Ethiopian, when we come upon him, is reading the book of Isaiah and not understanding it — that if man seeks God, God will find a way to bring him about. Even sometimes when man rejects God, as Saul of Tarsus did before he became St. Paul, God will not let him go to hell without a fight. To put it very briefly, in a sort of a summary fashion, what I believe I'm trying to express here, and what I hope you can understand, is the following. That people who remain outside of the church do so because of a conscious act in the formation of their personality as a conscious sin. It may not appear that way at first, because the sin may take place consciously and intentionally at stage A, while formal entry into the church is, say, at stage B, C, D, E, or F. But again, the reason people don't make the team is because they don't come out when the tryouts are announced. It is not because the coach doesn't like them. Perhaps one could argue theoretically, if they went for the tryouts and did well and the coach rejected them, then we could argue a matter of personality. But if you don't come out for the tryouts, if you don't admit the team exists, if you don't seek to go out for the team, develop your skills, learn the rules, etc., you will not get on the team, and you will not be able to justly complain of your ultimate rejection. The rejection doesn't take place because you never sought entry. Again, as Jesus says, knock and it will be opened, seek and you will find. If you do not seek, you will not find. And if you do not find, you will not possess. And if you do not possess, you will not have eternal life. And that is the reason, I believe, in this explanation, that one can argue quite justly that formal entry into the Catholic Church is absolutely necessary for salvation. And those who do not enter the Church sometime before their final judgment, in fact, are justly condemned. Now, at this point, I would like to point out that this issue is dealt with in a related fashion in the tape also available from ARM called The Last Judgment. Additional copies of this tape or any of our related tapes may be obtained by contacting us. You may write us at ARM55 Palen, P-A-L-E-N, Road, L-38, Hopewell, that's one word, Junction, New York. The zip code is 12533. We hope that this tape has been of use to you. We're always interested in your comments and suggestions, criticisms, etc.